been a lot of complaints about the microphone. So I took it apart and I replaced a few transistors. Now it's working fine, right? Thank you. Thank you for the six of you who emailed me with your bitter complaints. Thank you very much. The center gave me a new one. Okay, so we're well on our way now to defining what are these new molecules we have to make a new E. coli cell. And we've been through polysaccharides, and we've started in our second category of macromolecules and the small molecules that are their monomers. With lipids, I think last time I got as far as showing you how you can form an ester bond, right? Just recapitulate that briefly, that an acid plus an alcohol, when you condense them by dehydrating a molecule of water between them, you get this new functional group, the ester. As any acid will do this, we'll see in a minute, even inorganic acid. In this case, you could say it's an ester. You could be more precise and say it's a carboxylic acid ester, naming the kind of acid that's involved. The alcohol is always the same, OH. Now we're going to consider the production, the synthesis of fat. So fat requires two kinds of molecules, the fatty acid that we met last time and has this mostly hydrophobic character, and then this very polar molecule, the trialcohol glycerol. And those glycerol is going to be supplying the hydroxyl. This ellipse is in the wrong place. It should be this OH. going with the COOH, now drawn here on the left, of the long chain fatty acid. The chains are about 16 or 20 long. And so you could populate the end, one of the end ones. And now you have a monoglyceride. So it's a glyceride now of glycerol with that ester attachment. And you could imagine then the disaccharide, glyceride, and the triglyceride. So here's a triglyceride with all three hydroxyls of the glycerol substituted with fatty acids. And triglyceride is fat, synonymous with it. It's a diglyceride fat, not in my book, although it could be considered, I guess, by some people. Because triglycerides is what it's what's measured in your blood tests for how much fat you're eating, and this is, in fact, fat. These long chain, here they're kind of short, so they'd fit easily on the screen to see all of them and all their CH character. So compounds that have like octane, that have just carbons and hydrogens, that's it, they're called hydrocarbons, not to be confused with carbohydrates. Hydrocarbons just have C and H and are very hydrophobic. So this has a long hydrocarbon chain. And sometimes you could have double bonds in here, which means you have two less hydrogens and a different kind of a structure in three-dimensional space around that double bond. And we're going to elaborate on that now because it's another example of how structure affects function. If we think about the saturated fatty acid now, so we don't have to look at the whole triglyceride, we look at the fatty acid, they can be divided then into two categories. Those that don't have any double bonds, they have as many hydrogen atoms that they could possibly hold in this hydrocarbon part of their chain, and so they're said to be saturated with hydrogen atoms. It's kind of a silly term, I think, but it's historical and it's held. How could you have it unsaturated? Well, there's room for more. If you could add hydrogen across this double bond, it would become saturated. But as such, since there's room for a couple more hydrogens, if you would react this fatty acid with hydrogen gas, say, in the presence of an appropriate catalyst, in this case, it's an easy reaction to catalyze. You can do it with platinum, the surface of platinum powder. The hydrogen gas will react across this double bond and add two hydrogens, and then in this molecule that would have become saturated. Right. As such, it's unsaturated. It could have more than one double bond. If it has two double bonds or three double bonds, it's called polyunsaturated. So that's a term you've seen bandied about in the popular press, polyunsaturated. So unsaturated is good for you, polyunsaturated even better for you. Why? Well, let's see why. There's a free rotation about carbon-carbon single bonds. So as you saw an example of that in that halting though it was, glucose molecules as it danced around to form a ring closure, you can get free rotation around these single bonds, but not around a double bond. There's no free rotation around a double bond. So these molecules are sort of fixed. So this double bond has been drawn in such a way that the two hydrogens, so they had two different groups. If there's two different groups on each of the carbons, then we could consider this double bond in two possible conformations. One is when the two hydrogens, let's say, are on the same side of the double bond, and we could imagine that that double bond could have been created, let's say, by subtracting two hydrogens and forming the double bond with the other hydrogen down here and whatever other component was up there. Then the two hydrogens or the other two components would be considered to be in trans rather than cis. Given that most natural fatty acids, when they have double bonds in them, the way they're made, is in the cis conformation. So whether we're making them ourselves, which we do, or whether we're eating them, when we eat them, they could be either cis or trans. Right? No, not trans. They're always either cis or not. You don't see the trans very much, occasionally. Because of their cis, then this isn't drawn so accurately here, but it should be that both of these lines should be on the on the same side of the double bond, so as to produce this. I made it kink anyway, but the point being made is that you're coming up here on the left. This is graphic 3, and you go down. So there's this kink. There's this kink in the chain, and otherwise there's a lot of free rotation. But around this, there's no free rotation. That kink stays there, and you sort of divide the fatty acid into two parts that are connected, and everything is twirling around here, but over here they're not. Now you can consider this molecule in the bloodstream or inside a cell in an aqueous environment. And what it's trying to do then in the aqueous environment, as we know from hydrophobic forces, is to push themselves together and minimize the number of water molecules that would be caging around their surface. So if you have all this, saturated fatty acid, you have no restrictions. You can take on many conformations in space and adapt yourself. You meet a neighboring fatty acid in your own triglyceride or in a neighbor's triglyceride. You'll have no trouble just cuddling up with it and forcing out all the water and have a nice, strong hydrophobic interaction. However, if you have this constraint of this kink, then when you meet another person, molecule, whether it's kinked or not, it's going to take a little more time before you find the right way to get together because you have this stiffness associated with you. So it's not such a forceful, since everything is jumping around and wants to, on the other hand, just go apart, the hydrophobic force has to be greater. You don't have as much hydrophobic force putting these together. There's still plenty of hydrophobic force forcing them together. These fats are not going to be whether they're solid fat or this unsaturated kind of fat. They're not going to be soluble in water, but the force holding them together will be less. In the case where they can cuddle up without restraint, it's so strong that they become solid at a given temperature, 37 degrees, temperature of a mammal, typical mammal. So you have solid fat in your marbleized beef, which sort of looks like what you look like inside. And you have butter, right? That's solid. Whereas if you have these kinks, then you still get together, but not quite as well. So you're not at room temperature at 37 degrees. You're not a solid. You're just this oil. It's an oil which is not soluble in water, but you have like corn oil or canola oil. Right? So that's the difference between fat and between solid fat and oils. They're both fats. So they're both fats. One's called a solid fat, and the other's called an oil if it's liquid. Right? Yeah. We'll get to trans. So it turns out that, as you know, as you get older and you have problems with fat deposits in your arteries, atherosclerotic plaques that get started somehow. And once they get started, they can be added to by circulating fat. You can see this circulating fat actually in your blood after a fatty meal. So the hydrophobic forces are more, most of this fat stays in your bloodstream, gets into your cells, you use it for energy, and it's very useful in moderation. But if it's unsaturated, if it's a saturated fat, it's, the hydrophobic forces are greater because of this cuddling ability, unrestricted cuddling. It'll cuddle with that plaque and make the plaque a little bigger and bigger and bigger until you're constricting your artery and the blood flow is stopped and you get a heart attack. So it's not good to eat a lot of saturated fats. Hard to keep it straight, right? Like pH. To have this saturated fat is not good for you, compared to having the oil in there, which makes it a little less likely. So if you have unsaturated fats, they're better for you. So you're better off eating corn than steak. Now, despite that betterness, people still like to eat solid fat. First of all, it tastes good and adds to the flavor of your steak. But also, you don't like to spread canola oil on your toast in the morning. It tastes better if you're, and it's more used to it somehow. You still dip in olive oil, right, at right restaurants. But basically, people like to have things to spread on their crackers. So instead of peanut oil, you get peanut butter. So there's an industry built up for solidifying oils. And the way they do it is they take this oil and they hydrogenate it. They put hydrogen across these double bonds and turn it into a solid fat. So your peanut butter, if you look at the label, says hydrogenated, actually not peanut oil, usually corn oil, and they add peanuts. But they make it into this nice, smooth spread. And the same with margarine, making it more like butter, at least appearance of butter, and add a little color. Or if they don't add color, you get Crisco. So there's this industry that does this. Right? Also, maybe the shelf life is better like that, too. When they do that reaction, this hydrogenation of oil to solidify it, it turns out to be a reversible reaction. They use this platinum and this hydrogen. And so the hydrogen adds across the double bond, and you get the saturated fat. But then then you get a reversal of that reaction, and the hydrogens are removed by this platinum also. And the equilibrium is far in favor of making the hydrogenated form and the solid form. But in the process, because it's going back and forth, you get some double bonds that remain at the end. But because it's going back and forth, when it goes back, it could go back cis or it could go back trans. Now when it's made in your bodies with very specific catalysts that always make it cis. But this platinum doesn't know the difference, so when it takes the hydrogen away, it could take it away, make a double bond that ends up trans. So as a side product in this solidified oil, you get trans fats. Trans fatty acids, which look like that. Now, in the cis case, you had this big kink. But over here, where you have the trans case, even though the double bond is there and it's there's no rotation about it, the consequences aren't so dire because you're still pretty much going along in a straight way with your carbon chain. So you don't have to wait for this guy to swing around. You could line up more easily, even with another guy that looks just like this or with a saturated fat. Fatty acid. So the trans unsaturated fats tend to be solid and is a nice confirmation of what I've been telling you, right? That's the reason between the solid and the liquid. So I used to give this lecture, been giving this lecture for what, 15, 20 years? Started talking about the trans fat because it made this point that it's this structure in three-dimensional space which is affecting the visible and the usefulness. It's useful to have solid fat because it's in one place, you can walk around with it, and the plants don't care about it, so they can have the oil going up and down, maybe even an advantage. But for us, it's good to have the fat in one place, so you can call on it if necessary, if you're starving, 5:30 or so. So, what? There's no such thing as always in anything I say. So usually, yes, usually. The bacteria that grow in the stomach of cattle make some trans fatty acids naturally. Some of that gets into your steak. So there's a small amount of trans fatty acid in your steaks. But for the most part, it's cis. However, there's a much higher amount in these processed foods. So I figure if you're eating Crisco or margarine, you realize you're eating the solid stuff, so you got some trans in there. What's the difference? They should be sort of like saturated fat. And if you're willing to eat butter and rib steak, then okay. It shouldn't be any worse. In fact, it should be maybe a little better, but not worse. So I had a lot of doubts about it when the mayor banned trans fatty acids from restaurants in New York, bakeries in New York. And I said, this is crazy. I've been telling my students for years, it's just bad, but it's not, why should it be worse? I couldn't figure out any chemical reason why it should be worse, and I still don't have one. But I did take the trouble to read a few papers, and I could find nothing that explained why trans fatty acids are more solid, for instance, than saturated fatty acids. But I did find epidemiological data which showed that people who eat a lot of these trans fats tend to die, have heart attacks, etc., at a higher rate, not huge, but a statistically significantly higher rate than people who eat less of it. Right? So you can't argue with that, with those numbers. I couldn't argue with the numbers, and so I have to maybe grudgingly agree with the mayor, but I don't know why. Fats are stored in special cells. Mostly you find fat in all cells, but the cells that store it up for mobilization for use of energy are called adipocytes, and they're arranged in adipose tissue. And you can see that these cells have this huge organelle, special organelle for them, which is this flat fat globule, and they can make fat and put it in there, and then fat that you eat can be put in there, and even bigger than the nucleus. Fat's a very good compact source of energy, not just because it's solid, it can be in one place, but that pound for pound, it's more than twice as much energy, and when we study energy metabolism, you'll have a problem on that, figuring out exactly how much energy you get from a pound of fat or a gram of fat compared to a gram of, say, starch. So fat is a good way for mobile organisms such as us. You know, not much fat maybe in a potato plant because it's got all that huge root, which is the potato, and it's not moving around, so it doesn't have to worry about dragging it around. But if you trade in your fat for glycogen, you'd be in bad shape. I'd gain about 35 pounds if I traded my fat for glycogen. A second class of lipids, more interesting actually, are phospholipids from a biological point of view and functional point of view. So this is also on handout 2.9. And again, you go along as if you're making a fat and make a diglyceride, but then rather than put a fatty acid on the third and one of the terminal hydroxyls of the glycerol backbone here, you add a phosphate. So here's our first inorganic molecule. Here's phosphate. I say phosphate because it's shown here as a single ion. You could also lose this hydrogen and be doubly negative, and you could even lose this hydrogen part of the time at pH 7 and be triply negative. You could counteract this with one sodium, say, or two sodiums and have a solid crystal, and that would be sodium phosphate. Or you could have a liquid, which is phosphoric acid itself, which has hydrogens everywhere. That would be a very powerful acid comparable to sulfuric acid because it loses these protons easily, right? So it's a strong acid. And it has several of these acidic groups, has three of them. So this phosphate now is going to be tacked on to the final hydroxyl on one of these glycerol molecules. So it's an acid plus an alcohol. It's going to form an ester again. And here it is. If you ignore the R for a minute, this is a new ester bond between an acid and an alcohol. It's not a carboxylic acid ester because there's no carboxylic acid involved, but rather it's a phosphoester. So if that R if that R just equals H, then you have a molecule. It's got this long hydrophobic part with two fatty acids, a middle of some polarity, of some polar character, and then this charged group down here would be doubly charged, actually, here without the R. The R is H, and H would be lost, and this would be two negative charges. And that is a very common phospholipid, and it's kind of a basic phospholipid, because it goes on from there to make more complicated phospholipids, slightly more complicated phospholipids. And that's called phosphatidic acid. But we're not done with our phospholipids. So more reactions can occur. One more reaction, making a second. If this were H, this is OH. So we could do a second esterification at that place with another alcohol. And here's some of the alcohols that are popular, right? So if we look at an alcohol here, ethanol amine. So you see here's ethanol, which we met earlier, HO and two carbon units with its associated hydrogens. And then at the other end, however, there's an amine, an NH2, which we've drawn as NH3 plus, if we consider pH 7. So I switch back and forth showing you the whether it's charged or not. But they are charged, amino group is charged at pH 7. So if you use this, then the R becomes this ethanol amine hanging off here. And now you have a positive charge and a negative charge. So the molecule is actually electrically neutralized, but still has two full charges down here, positive and negative. So it's even more polar at this end, and just as hydrophobic out here. Or you can get fancier and start putting methyl groups attached to this nitrogen until you've actually got four, which gives you the complete loss of all the hydrogens and the gain of a positive charge. So this is an ion. You can't have it by itself. If you've got, this is called choline, and you can buy choline chloride, say, or it has to be always a salt. If you put it in solution, you get the free ion. So this is even a stronger base than the amino group, so that's, but still has one positive charge. Or you get fancier yet and put an amino acid, so this is, this part of it is an amine group and an acid group, and we'll talk about them in a minute. And then this part of the molecule has an OH, and that's used for esterification. So now you'd have still one negative charge over here, and then another negative charge brought in here, and a positive charge. So it would have a net charge of -1. But actually have three charged atoms or groups. And so it's even more polar. So phosphatidylcholine is maybe the most common phospholipid. Phosphatidylethanolamine is common. Phosphatidylserine is common. That's why I mentioned these. And you notice they all are a little bit more charged overall than the basic phosphatidic acid, which is also found. This is an abbreviation that biochemists use, or cell biologists also, to indicate a phospholipid. There's a circle which indicates the polar head, whatever it be, and just a jagged line to indicate both of the two fatty acid chains that are there, just a single line because we're lazy. If you put those phospholipid molecules into an aqueous solution, and you can buy phospholipids from Sigma Chemical Company and put them in, mix them with water, And they will associate, but they won't just form the usual globule like your triglyceride does in your chicken soup. They will form rather a more organized structure because first of all, you can get side-to-side association due to hydrophobic interactions. Now you say, well, suppose this is phosphatidic acid, which has a PO minus here and a PO minus here. Wouldn't those tend to repel? And I have to admit, yeah, they would. But they can't stand up to these 20 carbon long hydrocarbon chains and the hydrophobic forces that are putting them together. So they'll just have to bear it. And in fact, if they're ethanol amine, then they kind of, no problem, because they have a minus and a plus, and they can just arrange themselves to be sort of neutralizing each other and actually forming ionic bonds and make this a more stable structure. And maybe that's why we have ethanol amine and choline is so common. However, once they do that, they still have this big surface over here. Remember, this is also extending out into the room in three dimensions. They have this big surface, and another guy that formed down here the same way will then glom on by hydrophobic forces. But after that, it's insulated, right? It doesn't go on to form this big fat globule, but rather it stops at being this phospholipid bilayer. So there's two layers, and it's a bilayer, and that's a membrane. So by buying this stuff from Sigma Chemical Company, mixing it up, stirring it hard, put it in a blender, you'll get a bunch of these sheets of membrane. And the cell, this is how all the cell membranes and all the membranes in the cell are constructed. And as such, they produce this barrier against hydrophilic compounds. And most of the nutrients or the environment has hydrophilic compounds like glucose or amino acids or even water. So water, although it can interact with the head, can't squeeze its way in here because it's been excluded by the hydrophobic forces. If you had something very hydrophobic, if it could just get past this little this very thin layer of charge, then it could easily just swim around in here, come out the other side. Something like a steroid. So a steroid doesn't need a specific channel or receptor to get into our cells. Meets our cells, worms its way in, and it's home free on the other side. Stays in here a while, but eventually it could come out or it could go in. Half the time it'll go in. And then it'll go and meet its receptors and do its signaling if it's a hormone. Right? So phospholipids are the basis of all membranes. We wouldn't have cells without membranes. So that's why I say phospholipids are more important than fats. Look at all the functional groups we've met now. This is what, lecture four, so we're getting along. We had the hydroxyl first, and the amine and the amide, just to look at hydrogen bonding. Then we had the carboxyl to talk about ionic bonds, and the amine, right? And the carbonyl, when we talked about glucose, and sugars, and the two forms of the carbonyl, aldehyde and ketone. Now we've introduced an ester, two kinds of ester, three kinds of esters in a way. Carboxylic acid ester for the fatty acid triglycerides, phosphoester, and even the phosphodiester, that's not diester, it's diester. And we've talked about some special bonds like the glycosidic bonds and the carbon-carbon double bonds and the cis and trans of that. So that's a lot of the chemistry we've been learning at a superficial but I think satisfying level. That's enough then for lipids. Let's turn to our third category of macromolecules, proteins. So we spent, about half an hour on lipids? Even that seems like too much. Proteins will spend a somewhat longer time. In fact, we won't get to nucleic acids until lecture 10. So from 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, we're going to talk about protein structure first. And then the function of proteins. And the functions of proteins are so fundamental and so diverse and so beautiful that we will spend a lot of time on this macromolecule because just categorizing, making this list is somewhat of a framework for talking about how things work. So you already learned how some things work. Right? Here's the basic structure of the amino acid. It's amino. And the acid is carboxylic acid. They are joined by a single carbon between them. And then there's two more groups for carbon, and usually, not always, but almost always, hydrogen on one. And then there's something called R, and that's how one amino acid differs from another, is by its R group or its side chain. Right? So there's 20 different side chains, at least. And so the side chain is what, there's 20 different side chains, let's put it that way. Now at pH 7, amino acids are charged at both ends, and they're opposite charge, the carboxyl negative, the amino group positive, and so the net charge on this molecule is zero, no net charge, but it still has a charge. Situations like that have the fanciful name of Zwitterions, I guess in German it doesn't sound so fanciful, but so they're charged, but they're electrically neutral. I already alluded to that with serine. Now let's talk a little more about this acids and bases and what it means to be charged or not charged. If we consider an amino acid, and let's talk about the carboxyl group here. So I drew it on the left here as charged and on the right as uncharged carboxyl group, that is, it's protonated. It has the proton on there. Here it's lost the proton. So at pH 7 here in graphic 13, the equilibrium lies far to the left. That is 99.99% of the molecules, if you look at them at any given moment in time, are going to be in this form at the head of this thick arrow, but it's in equilibrium and it's getting protonated, and there's some steady state level of a few molecules that are protonated. Just as in water, there's a pH 7, there's 10 to the minus 7th that are actually in H plus and OH minus. Now, if we want to do experiments, and even in some cases in the cell, we're not always at pH 7. So let's consider the consequences of not being at pH 7. So here's the molecule at pH 7. Net charge is 0, mentioned. Now let's add hydrogen ions to such an amino acid that we bought and put into solution here. And we can put in as many hydrogen ions as we want, because we can put in a very powerful acid like sulfuric acid or hydrochloric acid that essentially completely dissociates. And so we're in control of the pH. Let's bring the pH all the way down to 1. So it's 10 to the minus 7th here to 10 to the minus 1. There's a million times higher concentration of hydrogen ions here at pH 1 compared to pH 7. In that case, that equilibrium reaction is being driven by mass action back the other way. That little arrow becomes the big arrow, right? That is, this molecule cannot withstand the onslaught of this million-fold higher concentration of hydrogen ions. They are going to protonate this guy, and now 99.99% of the molecules are going to look like this at pH 1 rather than this. And the same thing holds true if we would raise the pH by producing a dearth of hydrogen ions by adding hydroxide ions like Li, potassium hydroxide, right? That completely dissociates. The OHs, as we know in water, they will take up, it's mostly H2O, so they will take up the hydrogen ions, and you'll be left with very few. In fact, at pH, 11, pH 11, so we have, instead of 10 to the minus 7th, now we're down to the 10 to the minus 11th protons. Under this condition, this base is just cannot capture, from such a sparse population of protons, cannot capture enough to become protonated, and so we have a net charge of minus 1. Of course, this is not going to be protonated in a million years at this concentration of low concentration of hydrogen ions. So you can see it could take on different shapes. But still, this is a little unsatisfying. I'm saying, well, it's not strong enough, whereas hydrochloric acid is very strong, and this isn't quite as strong. So can we put a number on that, on the strength? And this is something you use in biochemistry course, but I only mention it here because I always get questions. And I think it does help to think about that satisfying to know that we can put a number on the strength of an acid or a base. And we do that by saying, well, if I said at pH 1, 99.9% look like this, how about at pH 2? It's 99.9%, and at pH 3, is it 99%? And where is it going to be 50%? 50-50 is a nice breaking point. We can consider what pH you have to go to so that instead of being predominantly here, like at pH 7, the carboxyl in the charge form, it's about half charge and half not charge. We look at the population of molecules at any given moment in time. And that turns out for an amino acid to be about 2.5, about 2.5. And that's given the name pK. So the K has to do with the dissociation constant of these acids and bases. So the lower the pK, the further you have to go to get to that 50%, the more hydrogen ions you have to add, the stronger the acid is. Citric acid in lemonade, it's about a pK of about 5. So it's a mild acid, so we can drink it, right? And acetic acid, I think, I'm not sure, maybe 4. We can still drink it in small amounts. Salad dressings. And the same for the amino group. We can go to the 50-50 point, and I say approximately, because the strength of the acid or base is dependent on the rest of the molecule. It could influence it. So they're in the range of about pH 9 for the strength of this amino group that's part of every amino acid. I can't talk about the name of that one yet, because I haven't gotten to that slide yet. Right now, we're going to talk about the name, so I can talk about that amino group in more precise terms. Let's take an amino acid, lysine. The name tells you nothing, but this is the structure. So So it's got here an uncharged form. It's got an amino group and a carboxyl group, of course, and this is the R group. And the R group has, again, an amino group. So there's like two amino groups on this particular amino acid. So for instance, if I wanted to talk about the PK of the amino group of lysine, I'd say, which one are you talking about, right? Is it the one attached to the one that's attached to the carboxyl? Or is the one that's at the end of the side chain? That takes a lot of words. So we'll put numbers or letters, we'll use Greek letters in this case, for the carbons in an amino acid. The first one, the one that's between the amino and carboxyl group is called the alpha carbon. And then this, therefore, because it's attached to the alpha carbon, is the alpha amino group. And we can even call the carboxyl itself, not give it a number, but say it's the carboxyl group that's attached to the alpha carbon. It's the alpha carboxyl. This is just what's been decided, alpha amino. And then, of course, this would be beta, delta, gamma, epsilon. So this is the epsilon amino group. And since I haven't memorized the structure of all these amino acids, even after all these years, in a way I do know lysine because I remember epsilon amino. So I know there's the alpha, then beta, gamma, delta, epsilon. There's four hydrocarbon groups before you get to the amino group of lysine. Epsilon amino. Rolls off your tongue.
Wait, sorry, how do you determine
the alpha is the one, the alpha is what you might call the central carbon to which the two groups that are common to all amino acids, this is common to all amino acids, have these three in a row. Most of them have this H. So that's the alpha carbon. And then the side chain is beyond that. Let's look at some amino acids. This is not from your handout. Just to show you, you have to be able to look at an amino acid and recognize it, even if it's in Courier font, and even if it's got its side group here really on the side. The side chain's on the side, and we have this angle for the common part, so you should be facile at seeing that. As in your handout, none of these groups are charged. You're supposed to know how they're charged from memorizing the structure and properties of the functional groups. This is closer to what we have in our handout, I think. It's not from your handout. In which case, we have the side chain hanging down, right, rather than up, it had before. I'm trying to give you some variety. Let's talk about a few of them. Glycine is the smallest amino acid. The R group is just H, so 75 Dalton molecular weight. Mostly notable because it's small. Here's leucine. You can start to get an idea that you can compare different amino acids profitably by saying, what's the character of their side chain? And now we have some ability now, you have by lecture four, ability to know something about this. CH2, CH3, CH, CH3, this is all hydrophobic. This amino acid has a very hydrophobic side chain. You could say, well, it's not hydrophobic amino acid because these guys are charged. But as you'll see in a minute, once they're attached in a polymer, that charge goes away. once these molecules are bonded together, much as they did in that ester we saw a few minutes ago. So if we focus on the side chain, we get at least a comparative way of looking at the different amino acids. I'm not going to go through all 20, but I'll hit about six or seven. Here's an unusual one. What's going on here? Here's the amino group, and it's all tied up in this ring. Here's the carboxyl group, and remember the abbreviation from steroids. There's a CH right there. So that's the alpha carbon here, beta, gamma, delta. And then the delta carbon is attached to the alpha amino, right? And it's only got one H left. It lost that H in forming this bond, so it's only got one H left, right? It's still charged, right? So that's proline. You see it better here. That's proline. And here's the, I'm getting too close. Here's the carboxyl. There's the aminos. This has got to be the alpha carbon. And the beta, gamma, delta, the circles around, makes this five-membered ring. Hydrophobic, it's all three CH2s. So it's a hydrophobic side chain and considered to be a hydrophobic amino acid. Methionine introduces us to a new element. There's two amino acids. I'll just mention methionine now, that have this new element, sulfur. Although sulfur in the periodic table, I think, which is hidden behind here, it's up there, is below oxygen, right? So it should be somewhat similar to oxygen in electronegativity, but isn't quite as electronegative. As it turns out, this is mostly a hydrophobic group, despite the presence of the sulfur here. So that's called methionine. Usually you can't tell much from the name, they're historical, but you will notice that there's abbreviations. A three-letter abbreviation, which is easy. Methionine is met, alanine is ala, glycine is gly, glutamic acid is glu, tryptophan is trip. But there's also a one-letter abbreviation. Some of these are easy, like M is methionine and A is alanine, but what about aspartic acid? A is used up already for alanine, so we have to call something else a D, so you just have to memorize it. You don't have to memorize it. Although, people who teach cell biology here, our 3,000-level course, are aghast that we don't force you to learn to memorize the single-letter amino acid abbreviations. And if you're going to go on to higher-level biology courses, I strongly recommend it. I was very late in forcing myself to do this, maybe 50 years old, and I'm still a little shaky with the D and E and Q and N, but it pays because now you're just going to see it's used a lot. You'll see an amino acid sequence, A, Q, N, E, F, Y, T. And so it's useful. You can always look it up, right? And you do. It takes time. So if you memorize it, you'll save all that time. Could amount to several hours in the course of your life. Here's serine. It's got a polar group at the end, just one CH2 and then an OH, so it looks like a little alcohol here. That's considered a polar amino acid, and most books will categorize things this way as to polar, hydrophobic, and charged. Right? And there is some differences in different books. This one's clearly charged. Here's CH2 and COOH, right? So that's a carboxyl group that's going to be charged. Aspartic acid, the salt would be called aspartate. Phosphoric acid, I called it a phosphate. Chemists are a little disturbed that that biologists use these terms equivalently, because we're usually talking about pH 7. So we know at pH 7, phosphoric acid is not going to be losing, it's already lost its protons, it's going to be a phosphate ion in our biological milieu. So we use them synonymously, and I will use them synonymously. Sometimes I'll say glutamate, sometimes I'll say glutamic acid, as do all of my colleagues. So that's aspartic acid D. Glutamic acid, being a little longer, is E. Right? There's a variation on this aspartic acid. We add an NH group to the end, NH2 group, and we have not an amine anymore, but because this CO is still there, we have this amide, which you may remember, CONH. So asparagine has an amide side chain, which is highly polar, as we saw with that amide reacting, forming hydrogen bonds with water, but is not charged. Same with glutamine, glutamic acid, and glutamine, glutamate and glutamine. Here's a whole new functional group. It's on your list. We rarely run into it except in this very compound. Never run into it except in this very compound. It's called the guanido group. It looks pretty complicated. It's got three N's surrounding a C, and it's positively charged. The charge is distributed over the entire four atoms there. And it's got a very high pK. It's even stronger base than the alpha amino group or the epsilon amino group. It's called the guanido group. So our charged amino acids are lysine and arginine and glutamate and aspartate. So we have four fully charged amino acid side chains. Right? Then we have things like histidine, which we won't dwell on the charge very much, although it is quite important in biochemistry. As it turns out, this ring, this has a CH2 and then this five-membered ring called a heterocyclic ring, because it's not just carbon, you have nitrogens at two of these vertices. And that takes on a proton when you get down to about pH 6. Its pK is about pH 6, so it's 50-50. At pH 7, it's about 10% charged by taking on a proton. So 10% is quite a fraction, and this ability of histidine to be under biological pH, a pH 7, to have the ability to bind a proton, but then easily release it as well, is used in many chemical reactions where the transfer of a proton is important. So we can pick it up and then release it. Pick it up here and release it there. Take it from this, give it to that. So histidine is very important in amino acid. We won't talk too much more about it, so leaving that for biochemistry. Tyrosine shows you some of the problems in categorizing these amino acid side chains. You have a hydroxyl at the end, so it looks like it's polar, and in some books it will be classified as polar. Other books will say, well, you have seven carbons here that are all hydrocarbon. It's really more hydrophobic. I remember it's very hard to get into solution at pH 7. So I'm with the hydrophobic guys. I say this is mostly hydrophobic, but I have to recognize that this is actually a quite polar. It even borders on acidic because of the influence of this ring. That hydrogen could actually be lost a certain percentage of the time, much more than water or ethanol. Right? So some molecules just don't fall into neat categories. Tryptophan is the largest of the amino acids. These double ring structure also can take on a positive charge, not as well as histidine, but partially positive charge. It's about 205 or so, 203 Daltons. So that's the range, 75 to 203. Okay, now we're going to consider amino acids in three-dimensional space. So I brought some models here. And I have here what? It's an amino acid. Here's the alpha carbon. Let's say this is the carboxyl in green, and this is the amino in brown. And since these are both the same, there's only one amino acid that has both the same on here, so it must be glycine, because it's got the two hydrogens. So here's a molecule of glycine. Here's another molecule of glycine. And these molecules are identical, and the acid test for identity in three dimensions is to line them up and see if they are superimposable. Nope, almost. Got to be. There they are. Superimposable, right? But suppose this were not glycine, but if I can do this right, let's suppose this were alanine. So let's make it a different color. We'll leave one hydrogen alone. We're going to build alanine. So here's a methyl group. Now we have four different colors. Already breaking this model. Trouble here. Okay. Now, are these two molecules the same or are they different from each other? No, they could be different. Are they different? How many say they're the same? How many say they're different? Abstentions win. Different one by about 3 to 1. Right? So let's see. If we put these together, actually the same, right? The same also, why not? This is alanine and this is alanine. People voted that they were different because they anticipated that that would be the result I'm trying to say, rather than think, well, I don't know. I mean, I can't see it. I'm not here to manipulate this. I'm not sure. It could be the same, because I know it's coming. They could be different, right? So you have to worry about knee-jerk reactions and that sort of anti-memorization sort of lesson. Now I'm going to change any two. Let's change with a green one. Oops. And we've had a bond breakage here. See if we can make it just a little longer. All right, I'm going to have to hold it. So I've just changed one compared to another. Now can we line them up? Well, we could line them up before. Here's a brown and green, but now the orange and yellow don't work. So let's get the whites and the oranges together. But now the browns and the greens don't work. There's no way I can put these. These are not superimposable anymore by changing that one. So, what do we have? Alanine and alanine. They're both alanine because they both have an alpha carbon attached to the same structure you see flattened out on the board. So it's only different in three-dimensional space. It's got an amino group, it's got a carboxyl group, it's got a methyl group, and it's got a hydrogen, and they're all at tetrahedral angles out into, as carbon does, if it forms four bonds, out in space, and this one is exactly the same by those criteria, and yet they're distinguishable and different in three-dimensional space. And this three-dimensionality is important. I mean, so suppose I took this molecule, and I grabbed it not by its center here, but by its, let's see if I can do this, left on green and right on white, and I hold it like this, and I'm going to meet somebody, what I'm presenting is an orange, right? And this one, if I take same way, white on right and green on left, meet somebody, now it's a brown, right? And these interactions in three-dimensional space are all important. Just think of those catalysts that have to distinguish alpha glucose from beta glucose. They have to see exactly what it looks like in three-dimensional space. So this is a big deal. This makes a big difference. Right? So now, so we see that all the amino acids actually have this doppelganger or whatever. So how many amino acids are there? 20? No, but how many can you write down that there are? 30? How do you get 30? I know there's a wrong answer I'm expecting, but I don't need 30. 30 would just be 10 other ones, but all the amino acids are built sort of like this, right? 40 would be the common answer, but then you forgot about the glycine. You couldn't do this. Glycine couldn't do this. So it's 39. So it's 39 possible amino acids we could talk about, and we can give them names. We can purify, actually, amazingly, we can purify this guy away from this guy. And if we just have a pure one form, and we shine polarized light through this, now you know light bends in solution in water or air, also the salts in that solution can influence the bending of light. If you have a polarized light, then you can see exactly how it's being bent. And this guy will bend light from looking at it, I'm not sure how you look at it, but it'll bend it to the right, whereas the other guy will bend it to the left. So they named this one instead of right, they use the Latin name dextro, and this one levo for left. So the amino acids are called capital D, or sometimes small. I think it's mostly capital D, that doesn't matter, and capital L, dextro and levo. Right. This is the dextro. I'll put it in my right hand, right? And this is the levo, or I'm not sure. Doesn't matter. There's two forms, right? And they're distinct. And I could look it up and say, if this and this are here and this is here, well, that's dextro, whereas the other is levo. So luckily for us, life is simplified, is that living things don't bother with the dextro. They use only the levo. So we have only 20 amino acids, L amino acids. So do we ever see, other than from Sigma Chemical Company, do we ever see D amino acids in nature? Yes, we see them. They're not parts of proteins. They are in odd places, like bacterial cell walls as part of their structure. D-serine is found there. So mostly we can forget about them. We have the L amino acids as the amino acids that are used to make proteins. And it not only makes life simpler for us, it makes it simpler for the cell. You can always count on it looking a certain way. That's the picture from Sadava, which is, I like, it's a nice picture, which does the whole thing quite convincingly without real models. These are called optical isomers. These are isomers. They're stereoisomers because they differ only in three-dimensional space, just as anomers are stereoisomers in sugars. And they are, and they're also called optical isomers because they will bend light in these two different directions. I guess not all stereoisomers will do that. While we're talking about this, let's revisit glucose. So the general, here's our amino acids, DNL, coming out at you, going behind the board, and then any compound that has four different groups attached to carbon has this property of the ability to form two isomers. That carbon attached to four different things is called the asymmetric carbon. The reason it's called asymmetric is that you can't put a plane through this molecule so that it looks the same on both sides, right? So this would be D on the left and B on the right if you went through and cut this A, C, C in half, right? So it's asymmetric. If we look at our glucose, which turns out, in fact, to be an isomer, a stereoisomer, glucose has stereoisomers. Why? Because if we look, do we see there are, can we find an asymmetric carbon in there? If we look at this carbon down here, it's obvious that this is not an asymmetric carbon, so it's got the two hydrogens, much akin to the glycine situation, right? How about this one up here? It's less obvious. I should always forget to change this. So you see the C double bond O, let's say going up here, and then the H, consider that it's coming out at you. So the C double bond O going straight up, and the H is coming right at you. You could have put a plane right through that, and it looks the same on both sides. So this is also not an asymmetric carbon. How about carbon 2? Look at that. CHO, OH, this whole business, and H. Four different groups. That's for sure an asymmetric carbon. So we can have two forms of glucose, D-glucose, let's say, and L-glucose. And in the Fischer form, which actually does give you the information about the three-dimensional structure, depending on which side things are at, all these bonds are considered to be going away from you into the back of the board. And that means that this is going to swing over to the left if this is L-glucose, where it's going to swing over to the right if it's D-glucose, much as like these models. So L and D vary at the number two position. But wait, maybe we shouldn't stop there. What about number three carbon? Is that asymmetric also? Well, it's got this CHO, CH2O over here, and H and OH and all this down here, which is different from up there. So number three is also an asymmetric carbon, which means there's more stereoisomers here. For each one of these L and D glucose, we can write two more over here, depending on the configuration on carbon three. And carbon four, same thing. Carbon five, same thing. Four asymmetric carbons, each with two possible conformations in space. That's 2^4 is 16. There's 16 different isomers, stereoisomers of glucose, you could say, or of L-glucose. Of this hexose, and they sort of ran out of letters and they started using names. Actually, it was the other way around. They give them names like mannose before they probably knew the structure, and some of the ones we looked at before we didn't talk about it in such depth. We just said, look, this hydroxyl is above the ring in this one, and it's equatorial in this other one, galactose, allose, mannose, and glucose. And we didn't talk about L-glucose. L-glucose you don't see much in nature. So you see only some of them in nature. Quite a few, though. Okay, let's put these together. We're going to put now our amino acid monomer that we know all about now. We're going to put them together by a dehydration reaction. Taking out water, I'm going to make, say, a trimer here. And the resulting bond is going to look like this. Here's what's left of the CO. It's now connected to the NH of the next molecule. By convention, we write there's a polarity this trimer, where we decide, unless we say otherwise, that the free amino group is written on the left and the free carboxyl group is written on the right. This one you see is charged, this one you know is also charged. So here's the amide bond. Now this is an amide. And you don't have to necessarily have two H's. The amide can be substituted. You could have a C here, you could also have a C down here, the C double bond N and C double bond O and connected then to an N, that constitutes an amide. So once two amino acids are connected to each other, we give it a special name. It's not disaccharide, of course. It's peptide. It's a peptide. If it's two, it's a dipeptide. If it's three, it's a tripeptide, oligopeptide, polypeptide. This is a part of a polypeptide chain. So what's this got to do with proteins? Well, proteins, polypeptides are proteins. Proteins are made up of polypeptides. A protein could be made up of one long polypeptide. But a protein is a more all-encompassing term, meaning that if two separate chains, remember the many chains of cellulose? If two separate polypeptide chains got together and stuck together very tightly so that they always work together, and that's how you isolate them and study them, then it's still called a protein, but it has two polypeptides in it. So protein is a superset of polypeptide. Other words we'll use is what's left of the amino acid once it's in there. Actually, I think I have a better picture next, which is the one that's on your handout, from handout 3.3. Here we've gone all the way up to a pentapeptide. It has the amide bond here, or peptide bond. It's called a peptide bond if it's two amino acids. So all peptide bonds are amide bonds, but not all amide bonds are peptide bonds. You could have, you know, acetamide and acetic acid get together, and you'd form something, an amide, but it wouldn't be a peptide. It has to be amino acids to be a peptide. So you can see that bond there, and you can see it again here, you see it again here. Right? Then you can also look at what's left of the amino acids. Let's take the second one here, which is bonded now on both sides. So it's got the NH out of the NH2, and it's got the CO out of the COOH. It's just missing HOH, as is reasonable. And this is called what's left, or the residue of the amino acid, which is most of it. But its character has changed because it doesn't have a charge here or a charge here. They're polar, but they're not charged. So you have this repeating unit or residue. Residue is the most common. And then these R groups are the side chains, which could be and usually are different as you go from position to position. You have an amino end or the N terminal. You have a carboxyl end or a carboxy end or the C terminal or the C end. They all mean the same thing. It's useful to talk about the backbone sometime. Forget about this side chains, which are giving all the functionality to this protein. Without it, they're pretty monotonous, as you'll see in the next slide. But the backbone then is defined as this part of the molecule, everything except the side chains. Again, these are terms so that we can communicate. I said this already. So there's the backbone. You see, it's very monotonous. Looks more like, you know, polysaccharide, which is the same thing over and over. Whereas proteins, if you consider the side chains, are far from monotonous. What are some of these proteins? Just to give you an example, the white of an egg, a hen's egg, would be egg albumin, mostly in that. It's a nutrient for the cell, for the egg. And so that serves a nutrient function. Hemoglobin, which is 80% of the protein in our circulating red blood cells, its job is to bind to oxygen at high oxygen tension or concentration in the lungs, and then let go of it at low oxygen tension in the tissues. So it's a carrier of oxygen. Keratin is a structural protein, so it's what's in our skin cells and gives us this tough exterior, so we don't ooze out into the environment. And also our hair and fingernails. Estrogen receptor. So that's a molecule. It's in the cytoplasm of a cell. Once that estrogen worms its way through the cell membrane, it meets up with that. It's grabbed by this receptor. That changes the structure of this receptor, and it goes and signals to do different things. Since estrogen is a hormone, it's exactly what it's supposed to do. So that's a receptor function. Immunoglobulins are present in your free-floating, in your bloodstream, and are used to fight off infections. These are what antibodies are made of. They're sort of synonymous. Immunoglobulin is the more chemical term, and it's a protein. It has the ability to bind to foreign substances, which is beyond the scope of this course. And finally, and what we'll spend quite a bit of time on, there are the enzymes. So the enzymes are proteins that help catalyze these reactions we've been talking about. So the addition of one sugar to the alpha end of a growing starch chain. That catalyst is an enzyme. It's a protein that is very specific for those reactants, now called substrates, for that enzyme. For instance, sometimes these are named in a way that they give you a clue to what they're doing, sometimes not. Most often they do. Beta galactosidase. So that'll take a compound that's attached as galactose, which we know, attached via beta linkage, which we know. It's at the one, but it's sort of understood here because that's the anomeric carbon. So It's going to take beta-galactose attached to something else. Let's say it connects to glucose. That would be lactose, the disaccharide, if you remember. It doesn't matter. Could be attached to something else. What the enzyme is looking for is a beta-linked galactose, and then it adds water to that. That's the hydrolysis reaction that breaks things down. The ACE usually means a breakdown. So beta-galactosidase is an enzyme that is able to catalyze that reaction, the hydrolysis of beta-galactosides. Each polymer is made up of amino acids and a unique sequence of amino acids. And each protein has an English name. And each molecule of a particular protein has a particular sequence. This is called the primary structure, and we'll be talking next time about other levels of structure of these proteins in three-dimensional space. This is now one-dimensional space. It's just the sequence of the amino acids. So in albumin, they might be met, ala, lulululu, et cetera. And this fifth position is ARG. Sixth position is glutamic acid. Right? How do we know that? How do we know, how can we determine? Egg albumin is about 500 amino acids long. So these are pretty long polymers, and that's not atypical. How do we determine that sequence? And we're going to take some time now and talk about some methodology. We'll do this a few times, from time to time in the course. For the most part, we don't tell you how this, the facts behind this story that we're weaving is have been determined. But we're going to take some time to give you some examples. And there's two purposes in that. One is to give you a taste, maybe, of what it's like to do an experiment in a laboratory, what's behind all this, just so you isn't so mysterious. And that's one reason. And the second reason, which is actually the more important reason, is that if you consider the laboratory manipulation of these molecules, then when you think about how they're manipulated and what they can do and what they can't do and how they behave under one set of circumstances as opposed to another set of circumstances, you really gain an intimacy with these molecules that you won't get just from saying leucine has a hydrophobic side chain. So we're going to see the consequences of leucine having a hydrophobic side chain. We'll talk about in terms of lecture what that does for protein folding. But by seeing how that might influence an experiment in the laboratory, we think these little forays into methodology serve a purpose in that regard. And we're going to have our first little one now. It's going to last about 20 minutes. We'll run into the next lecture. For illustrative purposes, I'm going to use, I set up this first case is how do we determine the sequence of amino acids in a polypeptide. So here's a polypeptide, let's say a kind of short one, from N to C, and they have different colors for the different amino acids. So here's one old method. It's not used so much anymore, but it still, I think, is useful. We make use of these very proteins that we're talking about, enzymes. Enzymes that will hydrolyze. We're going to use, in the end, three enzymes that will hydrolyze a polypeptide. Here's the first one, the most fundamental one. Its name is carboxypeptidase. You can see it breaks something. It breaks a peptide bond by hydrolyzing it. And its specificity is carboxy. It's the free carboxyl group amino acid. That's the only one it will touch. It won't go in internally. It won't go to this end. Only this amino acid will be cleaved. Once it's hydrolyzed, you get this free amino acid, which you can now separate and identify somehow, and we'll talk about that. Let's say this was attached to some bead or some solid surface. You add this enzyme, and you have, 100 million of these molecules, because that's a small amount. And so you get 100 million of these C-terminal amino acids released in the first few seconds as it works. And so you stick a tube under this, and you wash it through, and you collect it. And then you stick another tube in, because in the next few seconds, this is going to be the new carboxyl end, and this light blue one's going to be coming out. So you collect them with time as the enzyme continues to chew in from the carboxy end. Let's say it's serine first, then aspartate comes off, then glutamic acid comes off. This method depends on this cleavage being quite synchronous. So you see it's just serine, and the next one is just aspartate, and the third one is just glutamate. Well, nothing's perfect, so they have some lagging enzymes that got there a little late to that collision with that molecule, so you have a little aspartate still coming off at this time. Some that got ahead, you got a little lysine, still 98% glutamate, so you know that's what it is, right? You keep going, but by the time you get down here, that little loss of efficiency is 99% times 99% times 99%, and pretty soon you have, well, 60% is valine, so I'm going to assign it. And then 50, 40% only leucine, I'm not sure anymore. Right? At some point, it gets all mushed up, and you can't be sure. But you can still go about 20 amino acids in and get the sequence. There's our tubes. How are we going to identify these? how will we identify what's in the tube? We have this tube, just a clear solution, aqueous solution. So we need, usually these identification methods depend on separating the components, in this case amino acids. Separate one amino acid from another. So we have to take advantage of the differences between among the amino acids to separate them one from the other. So one very obvious difference is that some of these amino acids are charged at pH 7. They're also charged at pH 11. And now we're in the laboratory. We're not confined to pH 7. So let's say we stay at pH 7. And if we put a mixture of 20 amino acids at pH 7 and subject them to electromotive force, we can do this by an apparatus that has some kind of solid support and paper, like a blotting paper that's all wet with a buffer at pH 7 and goes into two reservoirs here of a buffer at pH 7. And in that reservoir, there's an electrode made of platinum that's connected to a source of electrical potential. You can't use a battery in this case, that's what it looks like, because you need very high voltage for these little molecules to move at all, like 2 or 3,000 volts, right, DC. So this is a dangerous apparatus. And let's say we put a mixture of these three just to see how the apparatus is working, alanine, glutamate, and lysine. Now, if you may or may not remember, alanine has no particular charge. It's electrically neutral. It just has the carboxyl and the amino that everybody has. It's got glutamate, which has an extra carboxyl group, and lysine, which has an extra amino group. So we take a top view of this thing. We put the mixture in the middle. We turn on the juice, come back a couple of hours later, and then take out this paper, dry it, and then stain it with a reagent that will react with amino acids. We can see a purple spot here in the middle for alanine, and there's a spot over here which must be glutamate, which ran towards, this glutamate be negatively charged, it would run towards the positive pole, which is the anode. For those of you who've taken chemistry will argue with me, the anode is negatively charged, but that's only in a battery. This is an electrolytic cell, or it's an electrophoresis apparatus, and the anode is positive. So in biology, the anode is always positive, and the cathode is always negative. And indeed, cations are defined as going to the cathode, and they're positively charged. They're going to a negatively charged cathode. So how would you know that what they are? Well, you can buy these things from Sigma Chemical Company. We could have run alanine by itself, lysine by itself, glutamate by itself, and see that they ran this way. Then we'd be doubly sure. So that's a way of saying, asking whether the amino acid in that tube was lysine or glutamate, or could be lysine or perhaps arginine. Maybe arginine would have gone a little further, since it has a somewhat stronger basic structure. Or we could have run it at pH 9, in which lysine would have only been 50% of the time charged. It would run much more slowly, whereas arginine would have no trouble, would have gone further. So paper electrophoresis is one way to characterize amino acids, somewhat limited to those that which you can manipulate to have a charge. I said that. Here's a picture of an electrophoresis apparatus, which has all kinds of safety. If you open the lid, it shuts off the juice. We'll turn to paper chromatography last time, and we are already ahead of the morning now.